Welcome to episode 188 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. This episode is a bonus crosspost to my discussion with Leslie Rosenblood, host of Podcast for Inquiry. Podcast for Inquiry is produced by the Centre for Inquiry Canada. Leslie describes it as a podcast for scientific, sceptical, secular, rational, and humanistic, and maybe now sentientist, inquiry. Make sure you go and subscribe there too. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I did talking to Leslie. Feedback and suggestions are always welcome. As ever, I'm only one sentientist, so others will disagree with my personal views. I also wanted to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's recently joined one of our online sentientism groups. More people join us there every day, whether they think of themselves as sentientists or are just interested in these ideas. The groups are open to everyone. Just search for the word sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite platforms. Facebook is the biggest so far, and you'll find us there. Also, check out the new inaction section of sentientism.info. We're building pages there about sentientist education, politics, rights, economics, justice, agriculture, environmentalism, culture, and much more. Come and help us work out what a more sentientist world might look like. And a final thank you to Denise and Tara Bella, who found our Sentientism Patreon and are kindly contributing to our production costs, helping us steadily nudge the world towards evidence, reason, and compassion. Thanks for listening.
My guest today on Podcast for Inquiry is Jamie Woodhouse. Jamie is working to develop sentientism as a worldview and as a global movement. He hosts the Sentientism Podcasts, hosts the Sentientism YouTube channel, and has published articles and presented academic seminars on the sentientism philosophy and its implications. He is building a range of global sentientism communities, open to all, that so far span over 100 countries. In our conversation today, Jamie and I discuss what sentientism is and what it isn't, its limits, and its philosophical, ethical, and practical implications. It's a mind-expanding discussion, and I'm very proud to bring you my conversation with Jamie Woodhouse. Welcome to the Podcast for Inquiry, brought to you by the Centre for Inquiry Canada, a national educational charity supporting your community for reason, compassion, and secular humanist values. You have answers? We have questions. I'm your host, Leslie Rosenblood, board member and secular chair for CFIC. Welcome. Jamie Woodhouse, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today on Podcast for Inquiry.
It's a pleasure. It's great to have the chance to talk to you and your guests. And you and your audience, I apologize.
The topic I want to talk to you about today is something that was new to me before I met you, and it is a concept called sentientism. And I didn't know what it was, and I'd like you to start this conversation by telling me and our listeners what sentientism is and why you think it's an important concept that people should understand.
Yeah, of course. So sentientism, I describe it as a worldview or a philosophy. And in one sentence, I'd summarize it as a commitment to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. And I guess the reason why I think it's important is because it's trying to answer the two most fundamental philosophical questions, the question of what's real and what and how to believe, but just as importantly, the question of what matters and who matters, the questions of ethics and what should we care about and how to live a good life. So it's trying to answer, in a way, the same questions as many religious worldviews and I guess also secular humanism. And the reason why I think it's important to answer those questions is that, this may seem a little naive, but when you run through all of the different, at least human-caused problems in the world, it seems that the root cause of them comes back either to a failure of compassion, you know, we just don't care enough about the victims or those being harmed, or we've excluded them in some way, or we've discriminated them against them in some way, or we've just got something wrong about the world. We believe something that is a fabrication or is incorrect or inaccurate. So that's why I think if you work from Okay, if we've got to try and address those two problems, either a failure of epistemology or a failure of compassion, that it's really useful to have a worldview that gives us a solid baseline, grounding way of answering those questions intelligently.
So one of the slogans for the Center for Inquiry Canada is almost exactly what you just opened that with, and that we want to use reason or and evidence or knowledge and compassion to improve the lot of people. So and a lot of what you just said in terms of having an accurate understanding of the world, because if you don't understand, if you misunderstand something, even if you're trying to help, you might be lucky and get it right and improve things. But if you don't understand things, you even with the best of intentions, you might get it wrong and make things worse or just have no effect whatsoever. And as you say, compassion, if you just don't care, well, then you're not going to make an effort to make things better. And if you are making things worse, you may be aware of it. And well, it doesn't matter because you don't care. Yeah. So what makes sentientism different from, for example, secular humanism, or the mission statement of the Center for Inquiry Canada to promote reason, knowledge, and compassion?
Yeah. So let me start with what they have in common, which, as you said, is really that evidence and reason stance. You know, it's centered on a scientific worldview, but it's not just science. That's a sort of formalized way of using evidence or reason. But I think of it as broader than that too. You know, we use the evidence of our senses with humility and skepticism, but you know, it's not just a technical scientific process. It's more broadly using information about reality to understand it as accurate as you can, and being humble about that too. Never being, you know, convinced we've got the right answer, because that can trap us in a dogma and close the door to new evidence. So I think there's, you know, there's that is absolutely in common with many modern secular movements and ways of thinking. And within that, there are so many different approaches that you might take to you know, naturalistic epistemology. But broadly, I think there's an enormous amount in common. And that universal compassion for all humanity is also something that sentientism shares, because the reason I care about all humans is because they are sentient beings. They have the capacity to suffer, to flourish, to care about their lives. And that's why I care about other humans. It's not just because we happen to be of the same species. So again, there's another really strong overlap there. But I guess the key difference is in that question of moral scope, where the center of gravity, for example, of the secular humanism movement is very focused on the humans. The clue is in the name. It's about human welfare, human well-being, human issues. The programs of work are very human-centered, whereas sentientism explicitly sets the boundary not by picking a species that happens to be ours, but saying every sentient being should qualify for moral consideration. And sentience, in very simple terms, is the capacity to suffer, to flourish, to have experiences like you and I think are doing right now. So that's probably the biggest difference, really, is just being really clear about what's the basis for that scope of moral consideration. And what, you know, where should it lie?
So this sounds a lot like, or reminds me of what I read about, I believe it was Peter Singer, and he talked about the expanding, I want to get this right, the expanding moral circle. I think that's the correct term, where we might start caring just about ourselves, and then we expand our circle of compassion and caring to include our families, loved ones, you know, a spouse, kids, parents, and then expands further to extended family, and then community, to country, and eventually getting to all of humanity, and then caring even more so about the animals that live and interact and try and thrive in the world. And is this is that a legitimate parallel that I'm drawing here? And is that something that has inspired you to talk about sentientism?
It is definitely linked, and Peter Singer's work is a particular flavor, you might say, of sentientism. And he didn't necessarily talk very much about this sort of naturalistic grounding, but that is his grounding for epistemology. And sometimes he would talk about caring about sentience as being an alternative to maybe a supernatural religious way of thinking. So I think he absolutely would count as a sentientist in that sense. But it's just his approach is just one flavor within a sentientist approach. So as an example, he takes quite a utilitarian approach that thinks about sentience essentially being related to utility. And there's a philosophical approach we might use to assessing utility and trying to maximize utility. But there are many other different ethical systems you might apply that still have concern for non-human sentience too. So, for example, a feminist care ethic or a deontological type of ethical system or a virtue ethics system can all actually be adapted or expanded to have virtues of kindness for non-human sentient beings, or in a deontological sense, seeing all sentient beings as ends in themselves that maybe warrant rights, not just humans. And a feminist care ethic might extend that sense of care and relational care beyond the human species. So there are lots of different flavors, but yes, Singer's is one, and he's probably one of the most well-known modern exponents of it, but he's certainly not the first, and his flavor is not the only one. And it's interesting because I think there's a parallel between how we think of sentientism and how thinking about humanism is developing too. So with humanism, I think there are some people who think it was invented in the Enlightenment in Europe, and then others are going, hold on, but these ideas have much deeper, much more ancient roots. And I think the same is true of sentientism. People might look at Peter Singer or Richard Rider or some sort of very famous people in recent decades who've done work on these concepts. But there are many different flavors of compassion for non-humans, and the roots of those ideas are deep and ancient and global too. So in the same way as the roots of naturalistic thinking go back into almost every culture around the world and go back thousands of years, and you could even argue they're pre-human, you know, and you might argue that non-humans in a way are sort of naturalistic in the way that they try and explore the universe and try and understand it and use that to navigate. That might be stretching it too far, but I quite like the idea that non-humans can be naturalistic in their epistemology too. But the same is absolutely true with this compassion for non-human animals and other sentient beings. So many of your listeners will have heard of ideas like ahimsa, which in simple terms mean do no harm. And that doesn't mean do no harm to humans. That means do no harm to any being that can be harmed. And those are essentially sentient beings. So, you know, the idea of sentientism and the word sentientism might seem quite modern and quite recent, but has deep and ancient roots. Yeah. So, but I think that's probably the main difference, is the center of gravity of humanism is a human moral scope, although not exclusively, whereas sentientism explicitly says it's sentience that counts, whoever has it and whatever it is.
Okay, well then let's dive into that. What is sentience? And I mean, we can go back to Descartes at least, who struggled with trying to figure out if he was looking at the real world, and the very famous quotation is, "I think, therefore I am," and for perhaps outside of philosophical thought experiments, most people are willing to grant sentience to other fellow humans, but it's a challenge both philosophically and even scientifically to know what's really going on in the heads or in the brains of animals, for example. So what is sentience? How do we measure it? And is there a binary, you are sentient or not sentient? Is there a graduated level? Is it a continuous spectrum? How do we measure being on that spectrum? And how does sentientism deal with the presumably different levels of sentience that different creatures have?
Yeah, this is a big, big question. So let me start with, I think, something that most people will agree with when we're talking about what is sentience, which is that it's the capacity to have experiences. So you might go back to Jeremy Bentham's, can they suffer? So if a being can feel good things or feel bad things, whatever those might be, that counts as sentient. So I think there's pretty good agreement on that definition of the word. And you can think about it in, you know, practical implications in your own life. You know, if I pinch the back of my hand, I'm feeling something. If I'm happy to be on this podcast, I'm feeling something. Those are all aspects of sentience. So they can be extremely basic, you know, physical pleasures and pains. But I think of sentience in a very broad sense, that it can be any type of experiences we might value. So that could include existential angst, love, affection, fear. It's not just sort of technical pleasure and pain. It could be almost anything we experience that we value. So I think that, I think, is a reasonably solid definition that most people would agree with philosophically and scientifically. When you come on to, okay, but what actually is it? This is one of the areas, and there are many, where sentientism itself is quite neutral. So it doesn't say, look, here's a particular philosophy of mind that defines the mechanisms of sentience and what it is. It just says whatever it is, whatever those experiences are generated from or what are those experiences consist of, they matter and they're morally salient. And that's true whether they're sort of mechanistic, functional expression of neuron firings in my head. That's true even if the experiences we're having are in some sense illusory, and there's a field of philosophy that thinks about phenomenal consciousness as though it may actually be an illusion. There are other schools of philosophy of mind like panpsychism, that think that consciousness itself may actually be very broadly distributed through the universe. In a sense, almost everything might have some aspect of consciousness as well. So sentientism is irritatingly neutral on those tricky questions of philosophy of mind, but it says that essentially whatever suffering really is, in a philosophical or a physics sense, it matters morally. So hopefully that answers that sort of basic question about what sentientism is neutral about, but it's the agreement on it being this capacity to have experiences and calling that out as the morally salient thing we should focus on as a characteristic. But then there are so many different fascinating areas to go into about the nature of sentience. Does it come in degrees? Does it switch on and switch off in a binary sense? And you'll find sentientists who will disagree on that. So some people do think it's more of a switch on, switch off. Others will think of it as something that comes in questions of degree. Others will think of it as a multidimensional space of possible experiences that has dizzying variety. But all of them will agree that those experiences matter, if that makes sense. And you asked that it's difficult to, okay, well, how do we work out which beings are sentient? I can come on to that next if you like, but you may have a question before we go on to that.
No, let's answer. Well, the question I was going to ask was to bring it from the philosophical to the practical. So let's stay on the philosophical for just a moment, and then let's bring it down to the practical, because I want to talk about that as well.
Yeah, so on the philosophical stance, that covers all of the different bases of what people might think sentience is. But the ethical philosophy is the view that all of those experiences matter, they're morally salient, we should care about them. And that really comes back to a common sense view of morality that will be common to many humanists, which is, you know, you can think about all these different ethical systems, but surely the core of any modern naturalistic ethic is recognizing that others have experiences, that others value things in their own lives, and it's our choice to care about that. It's almost that simple. And in a way, almost tautologically, sentience is identifying any being that might value its own experiences in its own life, and therefore we have an obligation to care about them in some way, have some at least basic compassion for them. So that's probably where I'd leave the philosophical stance. It's very clear on the ethical implication that sentience is the only thing you need to qualify for compassion and for moral consideration, but then being very pluralistic about, you know, the complex topics of philosophy of mind and neuroscience and what's actually going on under the covers.
Okay, so you're taking a stand that sentience matters, and that's like the key criterion. We're on a little bit more shaky, or at least contested ground on what sentience is and how it's defined and how it's measured. But let's put that to the side for now. I mean, that's an important conversation to have. Let's grant that sentience, let's grant your key proposal here. Sentience is what matters, and whatever it is, we can find we can agree that any being that has experiences, pleasure, pain, desires, has moral standing, as you put it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do we do? How does that impact our lives? How would if we take a standard compassionate person, perhaps a humanist, perhaps not, but they care about themselves, they care about others, they care at least to some extent about the environment, you know, but is not a sentient, is a sentientist, or at least hasn't heard of it, maybe, but not aware of it. If we accept sentientism and we adopt it as a philosophy, how would that change how we think and how would or view things, and how would that change how we act, both as individuals and more broadly?
Yeah. So let me draw the link from the philosophy into that practical question of what are the implications of this worldview and this way of thinking. Because while sentientism is neutral on philosophy of mind, I have my own personal view, which happens to be that sentience and consciousness are just evolved classes of information processing that came out of the fact that it proved adaptive for very early animals, probably in the Cambrian, to move towards good stuff and away from bad things. And that valence, that sense of good and bad, proved evolutionary adaptive, and, you know, millions of years later, here we are now. So in that sense, I've got a physicalist mechanistic view of what sentience is, that it just happens to feel this way to run this type of information processing in my head. But many different sentientists disagree with that. But one of the things I think, if someone adopted sentientism, the first thing you'd start thinking about was, okay, well, which beings are likely to be sentient? And sentientism, again, doesn't tell you the answer. It doesn't say, here's a list of species, or here's a list of things that are or are not. But it does say, let's take a naturalistic approach, given the evidence and reason commitment, to try and working that out. That doesn't mean we'll ever be 100% sure. You know, I'm not 100% sure you're sentient, Leslie, but, you know, I can have a pretty high credence because of different lines of evidence. So the sorts of evidence that I'd use when I'm thinking about, you know, are other human beings sentient, might include, I might think about our evolutionary commonality, you know, our shared evolutionary history through time and the adaptive pressures that might have driven the way we operate. I might think about our behavior and our communications. And those don't directly tell me about sentience or consciousness, but I think you can infer from certain types of behaviors and certain types of communications that there's a being in there that is probably experiencing things that's driving the behavior and communications. You might also look at our actual information processing architecture, particularly if you think in a materialistic way like me, and that start to think, well, other humans have the same sort of brain and central nervous system as I do, and put us in an MRI scanner and similar things are going on. And, you know, again, to Descartes, right, I'm pretty sure I'm sentient. So I can infer that other human beings are too. And you mentioned that it might be difficult to imagine what it's like to be a non-human animal. You know, there's the classic paper that people refer to of Thomas Nagel asking, what is it like to be a bat?
I was thinking of that, actually, yes.
Yeah, and I don't want to oversimplify, because, you know, it's hard enough for me to imagine what it's like to be you. Mm-hmm. You know, so going across the species boundary, you know, of course it's challenging, and there may be things it's difficult to get our heads around. But too often we use that as an excuse, because I actually think the basics are pretty easy. So I can use those different lines of inference that I talked about before, and I can apply that to non-human animals. I can think about our evolutionary context. I can think about their information processing architecture. I think about their behavior and communications. And the science on this is developing very rapidly and very impressively as we're learning more about non-human animals and inferring from that what their experiences are like. So I can use those different lines of naturalistic inquiry to build my confidence that there is sentience there. But I can also just do the direct visceral experience of, you know, looking into the eyes of a puppy and spending quality time with a non-human animal and, you know, intuitively recognizing that it's highly likely to be a sentient being on the other side of that.
So let me use that example and like, how can you spend time with a puppy, for example, and know the difference between recognizing genuine sentience from the dog or the puppy, and just essentially anthropomorphizing and projecting your own compassion, your own feelings, your own empathy, and where it may not be there, but you're projecting it because you are a compassionate person. So you're seeing how you would feel if you were the puppy reflected from the puppy, even if it's not there. Because we've seen cases where people do feel compassion for inanimate objects and their subjective compassion for that is real, but it's not sourced from that object. And perhaps it is from a puppy, but how can you tell the difference between you simply being an empathetic, caring, compassionate person and projecting that onto the puppy and being a discerning, caring, compassionate person and recognizing sentience and emotion emanating from the dog's behavior?
Yeah. And I don't think we can know in some perfect sense. You know, I can't necessarily prove it to you in a perfect mathematical sense, but then I couldn't prove you're on my sentience either.
Yeah, that's what makes it such a difficult topic.
but then so is all of human knowledge, right? There's no perfection to be had outside of mathematics.
So let's not get distracted. Given that caveat, I'm not asking for perfection, but we can still make some progress beyond throwing up our hands and saying, well, of course, there's no way to know.
Yeah, we can develop, you know, degrees of credence and degrees of confidence that are in line with the evidence. And I think that's the key, right? So there is some degree of anthropomorphism which actually maps to the evidence quite well, because we do have this evolutionary commonality. We do have a central nervous system and a brain. We do behave and communicate in similar ways. So there's a degree to which the anthropomorphization is actually appropriate because it maps to the evidence. And I think you're right. You can go too far. You know, you can anthropomorphize a stuffed teddy bear, but there are no other lines of evidence to substantiate your thoughts that being really is sentient. Whereas I think with the puppy behind me here, all of that very hard-edged scientific work and research also backs up this emotional sense I have when I spend time with them, that, you know, they can be happy, they can be sad, and it would be ethically wrong for me to torture them. So I think it's fair to be careful about anthropomorphizing, but I think at the same time, if that anthropomorphism is based on a genuine scientific understanding of the degree of commonality we have with non-human animals, it's entirely appropriate to anthropomorphize. And I think the other thing that's interesting is there are aspects of non-human animal experiences that it may well be really difficult to, you know, visualize or imagine for ourselves. You know, the sonar capabilities of a bat, or does a pig really feel existential angst? But when we think about the ethical implications, I think the more basic the interests and needs and experiences are, the more we have them in common. And there's a strong evolutionary reason for that. So, you know, a pig and myself might not share a sense of existential angst, but neither of us like pain, right? That's one of the most basic sensations that we might prioritize.
That's pretty much the definition of pain, right? Is something that you find to be intrinsically unpleasant.
Yeah, or you know, particularly a physical pain. Mm-hmm. So, and I think if you look through, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs from a human perspective, the more basic the needs are, you know, safety, shelter, sustenance, food, water, freedom from physical pain, freedom from fear, wanting social connections with others. The more basic the need is in a human hierarchy, the more commonality there is across the evolutionary tree and the more widespread those things are across the animal kingdom. So the fact that I don't know what it's like to, you know, navigate using sonar, or the fact I don't know whether a pig experiences existential angst, should not distract us from the fact that we can be very confident about the more basic needs, interests, and experiences that these animals, you know, for example, don't like suffering, care about their families, don't want to die. And there can be variety even there, but I think the more basic the needs are, the more basic the experiences are, the more scientific confidence we have that these things are not just human phenomena.
Okay, so let's move on to, like, what should we do? So if we accept that dogs and pigs have some level of moral standing, I think that we can agree that they don't want pain, they want to be able to breathe, they want to be able to eat. So what, if we accept these tenets, what obligations does that place on us as humans, as people, towards dogs and pigs and other animals? You said earlier, don't torture them. Okay, fine. Agreed, but that's trivial. But I think that there's a lot. I can think of a lot more implications of that, and I'm inviting. I'd like to delve a little bit deeper into that.
Yeah, of course. Let me run into it. I will come back to the implications. By again, sentientism doesn't tell us which species, for example, are sentient. It doesn't tell us whether artificial intelligences might be sentient or not, for example. It just says sentience matters whatever it is and wherever it is. So whatever sentience is and wherever it is, it matters. But at the same time, given the naturalistic commitment, it's pretty useful to look at the sort of central gravity of scientific consensus about how widespread sentience is. Mm-hmm. And my summary of that, given the current state of scientific knowledge, which is improving all the time, is that living humans are sentient. So congratulations, you know, we're in the club. But also all mammals, birds, reptiles, fish, and many of the invertebrates, particularly the more social insects, octopuses. And beyond that, there's some degree of uncertainty. So people are doing further work on bivalves. There are some types of animals, really simple animals, where there's quite good confidence there are not sentient because they don't have a nervous system. So sea sponges, for example. But that's a current sort of amateur summary of scientific consensus of how widespread sentience is. So that's quite a useful guide when we're thinking about the implications, because if you misattribute sentience, again, you can exclude beings that we shouldn't be excluding. So then to come through to the implications, again, there are loads of different philosophical approaches, and they might be more or less demanding. So what sentientism tries to do is to say, look, let's at least set a baseline, a sort of minimal baseline for what the expectation might be about how we would treat other sentient beings. And people will argue about whether that's, you know, insufficiently demanding, but let's at least get that baseline right. And I think one of the things you can do, which I think you do in a humanist context as well, is go back to questions of moral standing and moral consideration and compassion and say, well, in the human context, what would the minimum be that I would expect if someone said to me that I was going to be treated with compassion, with moral consideration, or humanely treated, for example? And we might disagree on the answer, but hopefully we would all come to the conclusion that at the very least, we wouldn't be needlessly harmed or killed. You'd hope that could be a minimal level of expectation, right? Because if I come to you and say, well, Leslie, I have compassion for you and I'm going to treat you humanely, but I'm going to hurt you and kill you for trivial reasons, you'd probably question whether I'm really extending compassion to you in a genuine way, right? These words have to
be. Sure. We've got every human society throughout our species history has come up with some variation of the golden rule. There are some nuances between them, but they basically, the best way for me to convince you not to kill me is for me to similarly pledge not to kill you.
Yeah. And in a way I'm almost not asking as much as the golden rule, right? Because the golden rule says, look, treat others as you would want to be treated. Or the platinum version of that is like treat others how they would want to be treated, which is even better, I would suggest, right? But this, look, let's at least not needlessly harm and kill.
Sure.
It's like a even more minimal
yes.
than that, right?
So yeah, I guess that is the assumption that nobody wants to be killed needlessly.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty basic. So I'm trying to establish a sort of fairly basic minimal requirement. But it's interesting because I think many people would quite comfortably sign up for that when it comes to other humans. You know, I'm not saying we have to prioritize all humans exactly the same, but at least in theory, we grant moral consideration to all humans, so we wouldn't needlessly harm or kill. You can argue what does needlessly mean, right? So we could get into that. But I think most people would agree with that with humans. They would also agree with that with some non-humans already. So there's a degree to which most humans, I think, already agree with at least some parts of the sentientist idea, because most humans, moral consideration and compassion already goes beyond the human species. So we think about the animals we share our homes with, selected wild animals. People would say, absolutely, you know, I would not harm the puppy that's at your feet because I know they suffer and it would be immoral to do that. So in a way, many people are already there and might be saying, well, this sentientism thing sounds obvious and it's uncontentious. But then there are other areas of human endeavor where it clashes viscerally with even that basic moral requirement. So the most obvious of those is in the food industry, of course, and the production of products that are made from sentient animals. And that's where the rubber hits the road, I think, because, you know, as a secular humanist, for example, or anyone who's trying to think about an ethical way of living in the world, it's quite easy to challenge moral problems that you're not complicit in, but nearly all of us are complicit in the way our food and many other products are produced. And in a way, we've been brought up by society to assume that those things are normal, even desirable. Whereas when you set that against the context of a sentientist, even minimal level of commitment and consideration to non-human sentient beings, those two just don't tie together. So that's probably the big bit. There are so many others, but that's probably the big beast.
All right. So, but just to make that explicit, even a minimal commitment, genuine commitment to sentientism, means that you would choose to become a vegetarian. And there's lots of ways to eat. There's no shortage of food let's assume that you're not on the brink of starvation. No beef, no poultry, no fish, no seafood, no pork. You'd be a vegetarian, and I would assume advocate for the dismantling of the factory farms where the chickens are in cages and pigs and cows are in pens where they can't turn around, where they're raised strictly to be slaughtered for the protein and for meat.
Yes and.
Okay. So, all right. I'm trying to establish a baseline, but yeah. Okay. So tell me I'm right, or where you and how you would build on that.
So I think, and that was the path I followed. So I was vegetarian I've probably been vegetarian for maybe 25 years, but now I've gone vegan. And the reason I've gone vegan is for the same reasons I went vegetarian, because essentially I learned about egg and dairy production and recognized that that was also another form of egregious needless harm. So I've cut that out too. So, and I think it's interesting because when people think about veganism, they think about food, but veganism isn't about food really. It's actually a philosophical stance that is, aiming to try and avoid causing exploitation, suffering, and death to other animals. So in that sense, it has quite an affinity with sentientism, but it's a philosophical stance with practical implications. It's not just, you know, a choice about which foods to eat. So I would argue that, a consistent sentientist stance would essentially take you to veganism. And veganism, even in its own definition, actually has, as far as practical and reasonable within it. So veganism isn't some sort of perfect instantiation of ethics that implies we've achieved some level of purity. It recognizes that, you know, different people will be in different situations and there may be difficult and unusual situations. So, but yes, it does imply that, you know, where practical and possible, we should try to boycott products that are made through the needless suffering and death of sentient beings. And it's an interesting challenge around the factory farming idea as well, because many people, even who consume animal products, would agree with me that factory farming is horrific because of the conditions the animals are kept in. But if we're going to be committed to a naturalistic approach of understanding reality as it is, it's really important to look at non-factory farming with a clear eye and to imagine it from the perspective of the animals that go through those processes. And the tragedy is that the worst parts of factory farming are also standard in non-factory farming too. So whether that's the, you know, how to put this in, I shouldn't really put it in pleasant language, but, you know, how do you make the animals pregnant when they don't want to be pregnant? What happens to the males, the various forms of mutilation that occur, and the slaughterhouse, you know, it's essentially the same slaughterhouse. So the very worst parts of the factory farming process are consistent in standard non-factory farming as well. So that actually takes me to one, a vegan stance, but also, and this will sound radical to your audience, an aspiration that we completely end all forms of animal exploitation and farming. So you're sort of maybe 65% of the way there, and I'm suggesting we should have an aspiration to go 100% there if we really think about what these processes are like from the perspectives of the sentient beings going through them.
Okay, so let's try and get a better understanding of what sentientism is before we start the full embrace of all of its implications. I think, although there's some, we alluded to this earlier, that some people may think that there's a binary of you either sentient or not, whereas other sentients would agree on a more graduated approach. In either case, does that mean that there is a strict hierarchy or a loose hierarchy where, you know, as far as we know, humans are the most sentient animals out there, or beings in existence, and you know, perhaps dolphins and pigs and dogs are at another tier, and that there's I don't know. I'm not familiar enough to give a ranking, but that there would be a hierarchy where more rights accrue based on higher levels of sentience, or in the case of a binary, all sentient beings have rights, and then those that don't match that one just have no moral standing whatsoever. And how do you balance competing rights or competing goals? You know, we evolved to be omnivores. We eat plants and meat and other animals as part of our evolutionary history. That's where we derive nutrition. But other animals are carnivores, and I mean, it's conceivable that a carnivorous animal could have achieved or can or does achieve sentience. But in order to live, they must kill other sentient beings. So how do we deal with the hierarchy, and how do we deal with competing legitimate moral claims?
Yeah. So there are fascinating fields of philosophy and science covering all of these things. And again, it's one of the irritating things about sentientism, which is it sort of stays neutral on quite a lot of that and allows that pluralistic diversity of opinion to flourish. But it just says, let's set the baseline that every sentient being, even the minimal ones, at least should get basic moral consideration. So it focuses on that baseline. But having said that, you know, I can give you a flavor of the different sorts of opinions you'll find within that about grading and so on. So some people will see sentience as something that switches on and off, at a particular developmental stage, for example, in human fetal development, but also switches on and off at some various points in the evolutionary process, so that certain non-human animals will be sentient and others will not. Others think it even the boundary of sentience might actually be fuzzy, such that you can never quite draw a perfect line and it will just fade away. So on one side, there may be things that are definitely not sentient, and on the other things, definitely things that are, but you never may be exactly sure where that gray area resolves. And you might argue that, you know, other terms like life are similar, right? You can be confident something is not alive and something else is, but when you start talking about viruses, you know, there's debate even amongst scientists about do these things count as living or not. So it's a similar, I think it's a similar sort of range of debate. Then the grading of sentience is fascinating too. So there are some people who will push for a more egalitarian stance and saying, look, every sentient being counts and we should aspire to be more egalitarian. I think even those people would probably struggle under some of the thought experiments that say, well, you know, is this mouse and a human child, do they really have the same range of sentient experiences and should they have the same moral weight? But there are some that push for a more egalitarian stance. I think what's more common is people do recognize that the sheer range of possible sentient experiences, even in my own head, is mind-blowingly rich. But then when you go across to other individuals and other species, it's even more rich and multidimensional. So there is this intuitive sense that, you know, humans are at the top and let's grade everything else underneath. And I think we need to be quite careful about that because us humans are very good at putting ourselves at the top.
that we are.
By the evidence. Yeah, we're at the middle of a circle or at the top of a hierarchy. But at the same time, I think it's fair to look at the science and recognize that we probably do have a richer, maybe more intense type of sentience than some of the other animals. But the more we study non-human animals, the more we appreciate not only their cognitive ability, but also the potential range of their experiences too. So there's been some recent research in some of the advanced marine mammals where there's a sense of, hold on, they've got stuff in their brain architecture that isn't in the human brain. So maybe they're experiencing things that are way beyond where we are. So I think we need that humility. But I'd also suggest that we need to be a little bit careful about just saying, look, we're more complex, so we matter more. Because actually, I'm sure there are ways that you and I can suffer or flourish that aren't accessible to some of the simpler non-human animals. So maybe that qualifies us for some extra consideration in some sense. And maybe there are certain rights that will be relevant for you and me that might not be relevant to a simpler animal. But it's also possible that us humans have cognitive capabilities that enable us to mitigate our own suffering. And so maybe some of the simpler animals actually feel some of the basic experiences in a more visceral and more intense way. Maybe they feel pain more intensely than us humans do. You know, we might be able to meditate. We might understand the context of our suffering. We might be able to take some painkillers. There's an interesting thought experiment about, imagine you go to the dentist and a chimp goes to the dentist. The chimp is, I would argue, going to suffer much more because they don't understand the context. They don't understand the dentist is trying to help them. They don't.
Right.
So I guess my appeal there is, let's have some humility. Let's take this naturalistic approach and follow the science. And there is a burgeoning field of welfare science that's trying to think this thing through now. But I think it is likely and appropriate that there is some form of hierarchy or structure, and that would viably lead us to grading moral consideration as well, not just saying, a mouse matters as much as a pig matters as much as a human child. But let's have some humility about how we're working that through.
All right. So I've got, we can explore so many topics here. I've got basically three questions for you, but I'm sure we'll get off on at least a couple more tangents before we finish. So my first question is a hypothetical, but I want to explore. I want to get a sense of ethical reasoning from a sentientist perspective.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a mouse and a human child, and that brought to mind. Okay, let's assume that there is a disease out there that infects primarily children, and it's nasty. I don't want to get into too many specifics, but it's a nasty disease, and it is carried primarily through mice. So I don't think even a sentientist would say that a disease, a virus, a bacteria has more moral standing than a human child. We have every right to give antibiotics or to vaccines or to try and cure. The fact that humanity eliminated smallpox is a good thing, even from a sentientist perspective. But we have a disease. Yeah.
And that's partly because those types of entities, bacteria, viruses, and so on, are just not sentient. Vanishingly unlikely to be sentient.
Precisely. Yeah. So we're agreed there. Mice, however, there's certainly going to be some debate and probably
they are sentient.
They are. Okay. Yeah. So here we go. So they're mammals. Mice are sentient. They're carrying a disease that is very harmful to human children. So we have a city, an apartment block, a home that has mice. Obviously we don't know if a particular mouse is carrying that disease. Would it be ethical to lay traps and to do our best to exterminate the mice from a particular area in order to protect children? And I'm looking at it from a sentientist lens.
Yeah, yeah. So what I would say from a sentientist stance is that it will only take us so far. But the baseline would be identify all the beings in this scenario that are likely to be sentient and take their interests seriously.
Okay.
Right. And try and be fair in the way we think this situation through. But that's basically as far as sentientism will take you. To go beyond that, you do need to start thinking about how do we grade moral consideration? How do we trade off different rights and interests? What are the different scenarios we can go through? So different sentientists will disagree about what the right answer is there. But the baseline has to be we at least consider the interests of all of those sentient beings. What I would say is that even that baseline helps us be more creative in the solutions we might come up with. So the default human response when there is any even perceived clash of interest between humans and non-humans is to basically kill them all. That is basically the default response without any almost any thought. So at least a sentientist stance would give us pause for thought and think, is there something more creative we can do? So whether that was vaccinations, which are possible for non-human animals, humane traps, separation, there are all sorts of different approaches you might find. But having said that, there may absolutely be situations where the right ethical thing to do is still to harm and kill some sentient beings because of some justification. So sentientism isn't saying, like humanism, right? Even humanism doesn't say you must never kill or harm a human. It just says, if you're going to do those things, you need a really strong justification.
Right. Because humans it needs to be a last resort, not the first option.
Yeah, and it needs to be a strong ethical justification. Now, what that justification is will vary depending on the details of the ethical system you apply. But sentientism is saying, look, at least recognize the sentient beings within that and take them into consideration in the same way as we intuitively would for all humans. But it doesn't imply there's going to be an easy answer. And there will be many difficult situations, as there are within intra-human ethics, where there are conflicting interests, and there may not be a great answer. But one thing I would say is that, one, let's look at those really difficult problems with clear eyes and not pretend there's going to be an easy answer. But let's also not let those challenging situations blind us to the really obvious win-wins that are staring us in the face. And I would argue that our food production systems are one right. Where it's really obvious, where the ethical trade-off isn't one of, only one of you can live and it's a trolley problem. It's one of relatively trivial human taste and social preferences against suffering and death. And so I think there are some really obvious right. win-wins we can focus
and
on.
And there's also tremendous environmental reasons that are particularly our animal husbandry practices leave a lot to be desired, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the other interesting things about the sentientism idea. And I think, again, it's an echo of many humanist arguments over the years. So humanists will say to people who resist social justice movements, and will say, look, one, you should extend our moral scope to these other humans, these unfamiliar humans, these women, these people of different backgrounds, right? Because it's ethically the right thing to do. But it's also going to be good for you too, right? Cooperation and a broader moral scope is going to be good for the humans that have the privilege to be doing the extension. And I think this is true in sentientism too. This isn't just about a sort of selfless granting of moral consideration beyond humanity. It's also something that happens to be a big win-win for us. And as you've hinted at there, the environmental challenges that are driven through things like animal agriculture in terms of land use and water use and pollution and zoonosis and CH4 and CO2 emissions and, the list goes on. Mean that actually we're in a really lucky situation where extending our moral scope more generously is actually good, even from a very narrow anthropocentric human perspective. So there's some big win-wins there too. But yeah, I'm not going to pretend that there aren't still going to be really difficult ethical trade-offs, because sentientism, like humanism, doesn't pretend to be a complete ethical system that will answer all situations. It's just setting a baseline.
Yeah, yeah. And huge conversations are like whether the right thing to do is to completely dismantle our animal food production systems, as you're arguing, or whether we can improve them somehow and get rid of the worst aspects while not advocating for complete veganism for everybody. I mean, there's tremendous conversations and debates and yeah. legitimate discussions to be had.
One thing I would say about those conversations,
yes,
and this is really important, is that human beings are sentient too. Right. So as we're thinking about, and I do think we should ultimately transition to end the exploitation of non-human animals because they're sentient. And when we imagine what it's like for them going through these processes, even the most in the supposedly nicest animal farms, a moment's reflection puts that in a very different light when you imagine it from their perspective. But the transition we need to make has to bear in mind all of the millions of humans around the world who are currently involved in those industries. Their livelihoods, their cultures are tied up in those things. And I like the term of a just transition, which tries to not just say, look, this entire industry is wrong, let's shut it down, but how can we help all of the people involved in it and all the cultures involved in it transition to something that's much better and have compassion for all of the humans in those
right.
systems.
And what to do with the billions of livestock that are currently living and taking that into account.
And I'd love to face those transition challenges, right? And actually, they're remarkably easy because the only reason these animals exist is because they're force bred. So as soon as we start to remove the demand from them and remove the subsidies from them, decide not to continue them, the animal populations will come down. And I wish demand would come down quicker, but it won't. So essentially that challenge is not really a practical one. The essence of it is we need to stop force breeding and the problem will resolve over probably a year.
All right. Two more questions. One is what I promised we would come back to, and that is, so far we've been talking about Earth-based biology, just animals here on Earth. And there's two other possibilities that we briefly considered, we have what we are calling artificial intelligence, and recently in the news, ChatGPT has been getting a tremendous amount of media attention, along with a huge amount of very heated debate about there's certainly widespread agreement that it's artificial, but whether it qualifies as intelligence is disputed. What I think is not in dispute is that these tools are becoming more complex and are improving in their breadth and scope and their ability to seem more interactive. And the other area is the possibility of extraterrestrial life. And if we ever find life on other planets, it's almost certainly going to be radically different than anything we have here on Earth. Questions about whether we'd recognize it, but certainly if we ever do see life from other planets, I don't see how it could be anything other than sentient by a reasonable definition if we're able to make some sort of contact with it. So how would sentientism apply to artificial intelligence, assuming that we achieve it someday, even if we haven't today, or the discovery of extraterrestrial life?
So the simple answer is it would suggest take a naturalistic approach with humility to try and work out whether these entities are likely to be sentient or not. And if they are, we should give them moral consideration. It's that simple. So again, whatever sentience is, wherever it is, it matters. And that matters independent of species, but that matters independent even of substrate too. But then within that, you'll find a dazzling variety of views of different sentientists about how likely these things are, whether it can happen. So there are some sentientists that think that it's actually impossible for an artificial entity to achieve sentience. There are a few who think maybe they already have. My personal position is that it is tricky with artificial entities because we don't have this evolutionary context that helps us judge the sentience of other biological animals because they obviously have an independent genesis, if you like, to use a slightly religious term. But I think we can still use some of the forms of inference to try and assess whether an artificial entity might be sentient or not. I think it's going to be tougher to work that out. But in principle, because I have this quite physicalist functional view of my own sentience, I don't see why, at least in principle, that couldn't be either replicated or built or designed into an artificial form. So that's just my personal view, but different sentientists will disagree. But again, where we will generally agree is if we think it's likely, then they should warrant moral consideration too. And there's also some fascinating work been done, and I've interviewed some people in this field who've been looking at AI ethics, not just because of how it might impact humans, but you know what our obligations might be to artificial intelligences and robots. And there's a fascinating field of robot rights. And some of those people will actually move away from the sentience idea to a degree and say, look, we may never be able to work it out. So in fact, what we should do is base our moral consideration for these entities explicitly on their behavior and the nature of our social relations with them, because that analogy to their potential sentience is as close as we're going to get. So it's a fascinating space, but yeah, the baseline is use a scientific approach to try and assess it, always imperfectly, and if they're sentient, then they matter morally, as moral patients.
Okay, so last question for you, and so far our entire conversation about has been about what sentientism is. I want to see if there's something that we can explore that where sentientism isn't. So I think it was in 2017, if I recall properly, New Zealand the New Zealand government granted personhood to a river that was and is very important to the Maori people. And it grants all the rights and privileges of personhood to that river so that it could have standing in court cases and so on. And I'm wondering what sentientism has to say about granting moral rights to an environment, to a river, because it's fairly clear to me that whatever else that river is, it is not itself sentient by the definition that we have been using today.
Yeah. So sentientism says we should have compassion for all sentient beings. It doesn't explicitly say we shouldn't have compassion or moral consideration for non-sentient beings, but it is quite focused on this sentience idea. So there's an interesting spectrum that your audience might be familiar with, where there's an anthropocentric stance which focuses on humans counting. There's a sentiocentric stance, which is where sentientism, which says all sentient beings count. But as you've implied, there's a biocentric stance, which is all living things count, which might include plants and fungi, which we don't think are sentient but are living. Mm-hmm. And then you can go even beyond that to an ecocentric or a holistic approach that says, you know, rocks, rivers, trees, ecosystems, the environment. And it's also interesting to think that, you know, we talk about granting personhood to rivers and mountain ranges, but we've done this for a long while for corporations too. You know, they have legal standing, they have personhood, they can operate as entities, and we don't think corporations are sentient either. So my personal view is that ultimately all moral standing does come back to sentience. So I don't grant moral consideration to rocks, rivers, trees, ecosystems, corporations, nation states, or anything else. But I do care about those other things deeply because of their impact on the sentient beings.
Right.
So I have a rich environmental concern because of all the wild animals, the farmed animals and human animals and liminal animals that live within it. So my concern for the environment is more instrumental. But there are some people who absolutely, as you've implied, will want to go beyond. And a sentientist would say to them, well, that's fine if you want to go beyond, but please don't exclude any of the sentient beings.
Yeah.
And I think what you'll find in the center of gravity of the modern environmental movement is this sense that we care about humans and now we care about the environment and we care about the earth as Gaia. But the modern environmental movement has conveniently carved out direct, even minimal moral consideration for vast quadrillions of wild sentient beings, and certainly excludes decent moral consideration for the many hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of farmed sentient beings that we exploit. So I'm okay going beyond sentience if you want, but the most important thing for me is that we don't exclude any of those sentient beings from practical moral consideration. And unfortunately, that's what most environmentalists do today.
Well, Jamie Woodhouse, you've given me a lot to think about. I know that in my conversations with many other humanists, while not being explicitly sentientists, they care about the environment, they care about the welfare of animals. Again, not from a sentientist perspective, but because it enlightened self-interest means that we should care about the environment. We should care about not necessarily how we treat animals, although that is, you know, that is important, but also it's our mistreatment of animals sort of comes back to haunt us in terms of devastated landscapes, polluted air, polluted water, polluted land.
Yeah.
And we are not islands. We live in an environment. We live in relation to our friends, our family, our communities, and the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we live on. And so it just makes sense, even from a narrow humanist perspective, to care about a very broad swath of concerns around us. You have taken this to a new level, and I find it hard to object to most of the things that you've said, but I also find that I don't quite accept them yet because I need to think about them. So I want to thank you for giving me and our listeners a lot to think about. And if people have questions or want to find out more, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, let me just close out with a quick response.
Sure.
You said, because I think most humanists are already closer to sentientism than you think. Because I think you're right that when most humanists think about farmed animals, we'll think in this anthropocentric way, right? You know, our treatment of them hurts us humans. But when most humanists think about the animals they share their homes with, I think they do think in a sentientist way, right? We care about cats and dogs and the animals we share our homes with because of their capacity to suffer. And as good humanists, I think we should be interested in consistent ethics and evaluating our own social norms and thinking about, why do I think about farmed animals in a radically different way from how I think about companion animals? Is there actually a basis for that? Or is it just something that I've been socially indoctrinated into thinking is normal? And I think when, as good humanists, we sort of introspect and develop our own ethics, I think we'll realize that that distinction is a social norm distinction. It's not one that's actually grounded in reality. And it's certainly not grounded in the experiences of the beings we're talking about. So I think in that sense, when you start from thinking about companion animals, most humanists are already there in concept. The real challenge we've got is to look at these social norms that we're complicit in and test against them. And that's one thing that humanists are really good at, right? Because most humanists and secular people have grown up in a religious worldview, powerful social norms, and they've followed a path of using evidence, reason, and expanding scope of compassion to break from those social norms and find a more compassionate way of living. And what I'm suggesting is that humanists need to avoid humanism and anthropocentrism becoming its own comfortable dogma. We've got to challenge our social norms and, you know, break through to this next level, this next level of compassion that we already feel for our companion animals. So I'd close with that final challenge.
And challenging our unchallenged assumptions, or ones that we don't even know that we hold, is one of the purposes that Podcast for Inquiry exists. So if people do want to find out more, Jamie, how can they find out more about sentientism and get in touch with you if there's questions or continuing this conversation?
Yeah, I would love to continue the conversation. I would love to. So sentientism.info is the main website and all of the other links are there. We have our own podcast on our YouTube. I've been lucky to have some amazing guests like AC Grayling and Peter Tatchell and Massimo Pigliucci and Diana Fleischman and Franz de Waal. So people can subscribe to that and listen to those conversations. Not all of them agree with sentientism, so you'll find all sorts of different views there. But we've also set up a range of global online communities around the idea as well. The biggest is on Facebook, but we are on almost every other social media platform as well. And those communities are open to anyone who's interested. They're not just sort of guarded places for sentientists to pat each other on the back. They're, you know, for open debate about all of these ideas. So we'd love people to come and visit and join in the conversation there and see where we go.
And you can find links to these in today's show notes. So Jamie Woodhouse, thank you so much for taking the time today and appearing on Podcast for Inquiry. This has been a mind-expanding conversation, and I thank you for that.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. Maybe this is the new frontier.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Links for today's discussion can be found in the show notes. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and engage in the conversation. Comment, rate, and review. Email us at podcast@centerforinquiry.ca. We'd love to hear your perspective. The Podcast for Inquiry is brought to you by the Center for Inquiry Canada. We are a national educational charity supporting reason, compassion, and secular values. To our supporters, thank you. If you have not yet contributed, please consider making a donation at centerforinquiry.ca/donate or becoming a member at centerforinquiry.ca/join. Your contribution supports our efforts to have rational and evidence-based decision-making everywhere. CFIC is on the web at centerforinquiry.ca. We are on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CFI Canada. Podcast for Inquiry is produced and edited by Lee Shields, Zach Dumont, and Martin Zielinski. Music by Anthony Lazzaro. I'm your host, Leslie Rosenblood. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?